This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll continue our series of programs where we'll chat with some of the best-known, most accomplished American composers. And we chat today with one of the most sought-after and certainly one of the most recorded living American composers, Richard Daniel Poor. Born in New York City of Persian Jewish descent, he studied at the Oberlin Conservatory and the New England Conservatory of Music, and then later at the Juilliard School of Music. He now teaches at both the Manhattan School of Music and the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. His teachers included Vincent Persichetti and Peter Menon, and a working relationship with Leonard Bernstein. His first successes were music for piano, being an accomplished pianist himself. You're listening to pianist Jianyin Wang performing from his Preludes Book 1, Enchanted Gardens. This is the first prelude, Promenade, and then we'll follow that with the prelude titled From the Underground. His success has most definitely not stayed underground, but led to Grammy Awards, among the long list of his accomplishments. He is one of only three composers, after Stravinsky and Copland, to be signed to an exclusive recording contract with Sony Classical. He has been commissioned by many top international classical musicians, including such names as Yo-Yo Ma, Jesse Norman, Dawn Upshaw, Emmanuel Axe, Thomas Hampson, and the Emerson and Guarneri String Quartets, also by many major orchestras and festivals. Even his singular operatic effort, Margaret Garner, written with Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, was a success. He has a recent recording of his works on a continuing series on the Naxos label. I'm going to split this chat into two programs so we hear a bit more of Mr. Daniel Poor's music. I caught up with him at his working studio in Manhattan, along with, on a warmish day, an AC unit that chimed in and out.
I'm here with composer Richard Dynapour. Actually, what's weird, in the last couple weeks, I've had a spate of interviews with some of the most performed and widely known American composers, with all very different, but it's kind of interesting, including you. On the recording side, you've had that wonderful thing where you had the Sony contract, now you're recording on Naxos, you've had your music performed by some of the top soloists, ensembles, conductors in the world, some of the great halls and venues. So a little weird question to start here, but this moniker of most performed and in-demand American composer, does that really stand up, but should it be more than what that is? Do you understand? I mean, you are in comparison to maybe other American composers, but in a general sense of music being performed and programmed, is that moniker really standing up?
Yeah, I think really what's more important than that is not, you know, how many first performances you get. I think the last piece that I finished and had premiered was the 110th commission that I, you know, had of a premiere, which is a lot, you know, for a guy my age. But to me, it's not the first performance. It's how many of those works stay in circulation. You know, I've been blessed to have a lot of recordings over the years, and those recordings, I think, are important because they serve as a kind of, they serve as part of one's legacy. But to me, what's really important, and I think what composers all either secretly or not so secretly wish for, is that their music stay in circulation. And so what I feel grateful for is that there's a good percentage of my work that somehow has stuck around. You know, I mean, you know, some of the bigger pieces might not get performed every single year, but they keep coming back. And then, you know, smaller things are just sort of everywhere. They're all around. And then there is an entire contingent of musicians who only know me as a composer for the piano, you know, because I've written so much solo piano music. You know, I'm one of those guys, too. You know, and that's interesting to me. And then there's a whole other contingent of people who know me only as a composer for the theater. So, you know, part of that, for me, if there's anything I'm the most proud of, it's the fact that a good deal of my music is still, if not in recordings, is in performance, is still in circulation. And while recordings are so important to me, as they are to many of the people you've interviewed recently, none of us really write for recordings.
Right.
We write for that inimitable live experience, you know, of going into a space and hearing the work.
You said of that age, you turned 60 earlier this year, which means you had, coming up in your career, you were at a time when you were studying, around you were still swirling, not maybe the strength they were, but the isms and dogmas and processes of how to compose, and the pressure, maybe, of making sure that you chose one of them. You rejected some of these. Your comments are, I was glad to be between revolutions, the sort of dictatorship of the past. These are kind of your words. Take us through that time and what you had to experiment with or fight off.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You're good. That's a great question. And for me, to make sense of this, I've got to go even further back. You see, I'm a first-generation American of parents who were born in Iran and came here when they were fairly young. And the Persian culture is a very, you know, to this day, it's still a strong presence in my life, even though my sister and I were brought up to be Americans. You know, my parents wanted that, and I really embraced it. I mean, so much so that I, you know, my first job was as a bat boy for a Major League Baseball team. You can't get more American than that. But this other thing is there, and as a result of that, I was maybe hyper aware of the multicultural aspect that existed then and exists now in America. I saw us as clearly from first-hand experience as a melting pot country. And so it was very natural for me to understand eclecticism in music that way.
Right.
And a lot of people say, well, you know, you were very fortunate to have like two of the great teachers, you know, mentors of composition in the 20th century as your teachers. And they were like 360 degrees opposite, you know, 180, I mean, opposite. One was Vincent Persichetti, who was like Gandhi, you know. And then the other was Leonard Bernstein, who was like a crazy rabbi, with the most amazing mental faculties I've ever seen, you know, and the greatest deer I've ever seen. But they both had this one thing in common. They both believed that it was never about the style. It was how you communicated in the chosen style. And that it was really all about the art of communication and how we connect with one another musically. So I was given that passport, if you will, to not mind so much about that.
But did you have to try them out did you have to try writing 12-tone surrealistic
of course.
Processes?
Of course.
Minimal sign?
Oh, yeah. And I did. See, the thing is, I believe that the answer is usually letter D. It's usually all of the above. Yeah. I think if you look at the great, great composers, the greatest composers of every generation, they found a way to include and assimilate everything that was going on around them. And I think when you allow everything to be included and then filtered through your own idiosyncratic personality, that's when you have the opportunity to have a range.
Right.
You know, maybe a style that has a certain amount of range. You know, Mozart was writing Turkish music for a period of time when that was the vogue,
right?
But he was also enamored of the Italians, you know, and he loved the German composers who were writing in England. You know, his favorite was J.C. Bach. You know, when J.C. Bach died, he wrote in his Tagbuch, "The great Bach is dead," and everybody thought for years he meant J.S. Bach. And then in 1790, he discovered the father of J.C. Bach and realized, oh my God, this guy.
That's where it came from.
Yeah. So anyway, but I mean, you know, these composers, they assimilated everything.
But you had colleagues back then that were choosing a singular path.
That were very, very polemical also.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was silly, even back then. For me, part of the reason why I think I could see through a lot of this was that I grew up primarily as a pianist. So I was playing a lot of music that I could see right away. I was playing late Beethoven sonatas.
Right.
I could see right away what the difference was between great and not so great music. I developed an instinctual feel. I learned the well-tempered clavier from the Bartok edition, which has all the voices in open score. You see, it's very interesting to me to look back at this and to see, I saw the connectedness of all these things, you see, in a very natural way. And again, the teachers that I chose or chose me, whichever way you look at it, they also were in that mindset as well. Even back to my first teacher at NEC, who was John Heiss, who was an amazing, he's still alive, amazing guy. And he came from a more sort of academically minded world. But, you know, he loved music in all its forms. And I learned a great deal from him about Stravinsky in particular. But he said to me one day, you know, you probably wouldn't get into Princeton, this is in 1970s, with your portfolio, but I don't think you really care about that, do you?
Yeah, or Columbia.
Yeah, exactly. Although I was accepted to Columbia, but I decided to go to Juilliard because I knew deep down that the only way to grow was to hear my music as often as possible. And, you know, in a lot of these universities, that's changed, but in the 80s, it reminded me so much of that moment in George Bernard Shaw's Don Juan in Hell, where the characters of Don Giovanni are sitting around the devil, and Doña Ana asks the devil, was Mozart ever down here? And the devil said, yeah, well, he came down for a little while, but he got really bored. He complained that nobody worked, that people only talked about working. And that's kind of the way, you know, it's always thoughts about the thing. In those days, not so much now anymore, but then it was more thoughts about the thing than the thing itself in these schools. And that really bothered me because I was also a performing musician. A lot of this stuff didn't jibe with me as well, and I think that kind of saved me.
From a work composed in memory to those who perished in the tragic events of 9/11, here's the Sanctus and Benedictus from my guest Richard Daniel Poor's American Requiem. The Pacific Symphony Orchestra and Chorale are led by Carl St. Clair.
Sanctus.
want to talk about the emotional part of music, but on the other side, your composer doesn't have any qualms about using traditional titles or symphonies or concertos and things like that. They usually have a
sometimes.
They have a subtitle. And a lot of those subtexts and the pieces themselves, I don't know about the best way to put this, but your themes are often very universal, engulfing mankind. They're serious themes. There's not a lot of intricate personal. That's always been who you are. The music has a very serious import to it. It's sort of on a global, universal nature, many of these themes.
Yeah, you know, there is that sort of lineage of philosopher/composers that are constantly thinking about life and death and everything in between. And I didn't really choose it, you know, in the same way that I never really chose to be a musician. I think music chose me. And I think that is usually the case with most people. But I didn't really say that, you know, I'm going to be this kind of composer. It's just, you know, you write from the place of what you care about most deeply. And I think these are the things I've cared about most deeply in my life. These issues, these things I've written about. It's interesting because, you know, I stopped reading my reviews for a very long time. And just all of a sudden, for the first time, I've just been sort of curious and I've taken a peek again. Partly because Naxos has said, you should look at some of the reviews that you've gotten on your recent CDs because you've gotten some really great press and we would like you to know about this so we can work together. And I said, okay. And, you know, one of them said, the music is always across the boards convincing in spite of its political undertones. And the thing is, I thought that was so strange because I'd never really thought of myself in a political way at all. I'm really of the belief that when a political issue becomes a humanitarian issue, that's where you'll find me. Like, for instance, you know, I believe that World War II, when we got involved in the Second World War, it was a humanitarian mission, really, to rid the world of National Socialism. You know, that was an act of humanitarianism,
right,
to save the world from eating itself alive. You know, in that way, I think of the documents, if you can call the pieces documents. I see them, you know, if it can be said this way, as humanitarian documents, documents about us, you know.
Well, I think they take on, I'm thinking of Towards a Season of Peace, so pieces like that, large pieces.
Or an American Requiem.
You're right, which on the surface take on universal themes for everybody, but then everybody brings their certain slant, political or whatever, to it.
Correct. Correct.
And
you just hit the nail on the head.
You hear what they want to hear, but
you hit the nail on the head, and you actually touched on something which is very central in my awareness. You see, I had an incident in the summer with this new piece that I'm working on, in which we had a kind of a brunch, members of the community, and one of them said, you know, I'm not sure if members of my community or congregation will choose to come to this. And I said, you've got to understand something about me and every artist you'll ever meet. Our job is not to tell you how you're supposed to feel when we write a piece. Our job is to write the piece, put it out there, and let you decide how you're going to feel. If you feel it's disturbing, then it's disturbing. If you feel it's uplifting, then it's uplifting. If you feel it's cause for some inner alarm in you, then that's what it is. But the bottom line is, we write not to tell you how you're supposed to feel. That's your job.
One thing you do want, however, which you've on record for, and maybe you mean all music is, but you want music to have this visceral impact.
Yes. In other words, I'm happy when I see that there is a response that's something other than indifference. Because to me, hate has never been the opposite of love. Okay. Indifference is the opposite of love.
Okay.
So, and composers all want to be, I would say, more than even loved. I think we want to be understood, you know? I mean, to me, what matters more than anything is to really be heard. To really be heard and understood. And I think if there's enough interest in it, then, you know, regardless of how passionate the feeling is in one direction or another, the passion is good, you see. What's not good is the indifference. And I'm speaking not just for me.
Is that litmus test of the visceral impact something you also then expect of other music other than your own?
I'd like that.
The music that lives with you that's not yours.
I'd like that. You know, it's funny. On the other day on the radio, I was just walking into the house upstairs, and I heard the end of Arvo Pärt's Fratres, you know, the version for violin, solo, and orchestra, and Gil was playing. You know, we've worked together, and I've known him for many, many years, and I just could tell it was him. You know, right away, I knew that was his sound. And I also, back in 2002, when I was living in Berlin, you know, I spent a bit of time with Arvo Pärt. I found him to be a wonderful guy, even though he didn't say very much, you know, in the time we were together. He didn't speak all that often, but just being with him was interesting and fun and illuminating, too, at times. But the moment I heard it, it's like I heard the sound. It's like seeing an old friend walk down the street that you haven't seen in years. You know, there was a sense of recognition, understanding, both of the performer and of the composer, that once again, for that brief moment, made me feel just a little less isolated. Now, that's not what you would call a visceral impact, but it is a real emotional response. You know, it's a response that allows us for that brief moment not to feel alone, which is, I think, a very important part of what music is about for me. My life, I mean, I've been married for 11 years and I got married rather late, but life for me as a composer has been at times very lonely. And so,
it's a lonely profession.
It's a very lonely profession. People don't want to talk about this, by the way, but it is, you know, and we spend enormous hours by ourselves. It's the only way we can do it. Yet, the irony of this is that we're spending all this time alone in order to create something that allows us in these brief moments to be connected with one another again. It's interesting, you know? And to me, I think that that's, for me, the great thing is that feeling of connection. You have to write music that sounds, because so much of it is in the sound. You have to write music that's memorable for this to happen. And you have to write music that at times is stunning, either from its the sheer force of its energy, or maybe sometimes from the sheer force of its delicacy. But it has to stun you, too, once in a while, you know?
Well, that's one of the attributes about your music that I love, are the shifts on both sides. You don't just wait for the up-tempo stuff to get interesting. The other end can be as compelling. I love that in your music.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's great.
Taking a while to come to grips with his Persian-Iranian heritage in his music, here are the opening two movements, Lamentation and Desecration, from the 2011 Darkness in the Ancient Valley. The Nashville Symphony is led by their music director Giancarlo Guerrero. Thank you.
You mentioned your Iranian background. You're actually, your heritage is Jewish Iranian. Your quote is, I'm an American composer with a Persian memory.
Middle Eastern memory,
true. How have both of those cropped up, appeared in your music at different times? I'm getting a feeling that the Persian stuff is a little bit later.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the other thing I should say is that, you know, my family, it's been a little complex because it's also another one of those all of the aboves. Because, you know, on my mother's side, it's a kind of a combination of Jewish and Christian. So, you know, spiritually, I'm sort of an amalgamation of both, you know, in a way. In that sense, my sort of spiritual metabolism is like a braid. But what happened with me when I was a kid, you know, I went to Iran at 7, became very sick, was there with my family. I almost died from nephritis. They had to bring me back. Thank God we only spent a year there. We came back weeks after the Beatles first arrived, which was also, for me, like an epiphany of epiphanies. Yeah. And then, you know, the hostage crisis and the revolution in which I had an uncle who was imprisoned, tortured, and executed by the Ayatollah's regime. Another one who escaped from the Evin prison. I mean, these are like stories that movies, you know, could come out of. And as a result of all this unpleasantness, I kept my Persian heritage at a real distance. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I was almost embarrassed by all of this, you know. And then around 2000, and my mom also had been the equivalent of like a court sculptor to the Pahlavi family. She's still alive, God bless her. She's still working. She's producing great stuff still to this day. But back then, you know, her career was really starting to mushroom out, and she was regularly going to Tehran to work on pieces for the Shah's family. And she developed a very close relationship with Farah Pahlavi over the years and reconnected with her, like, in around 2006, 2007. And she started feeding me with information just about, you know, what's going on in Iran and the way the women are sort of kind of taking the bull by the horns and fighting for their own rights, etc. And then with these rigged elections, you know, in 2009, I think it was, where that girl Neda Sultan was killed, you know, on CNN from a stray bullet, I got interested again, and I started reading all the Persian poets that I remember hearing as a child at the dinner table. I started looking at Rumi again. I started studying Khayyam and Hafez. And I realized, wow, I thought, this is incredible stuff. Why I should have really spent more time with this. And I just started immersing myself in it. And as a result of that, a lot of music came out of it between 2009 and just as recently as this last year. Yeah. Probably the most important piece was Toward a Season of Peace, right, in which I was approached by a lovely woman who was on the board of the Pacific Symphony saying, would you write us a big piece for the Persian New Year? And I said, I'll do it only on the condition that I can use it as an opportunity for the three great religions who've been trying to wipe each other off the face of the earth for the last how many years, to sort of, in a kind of the model of the work itself, come to an understanding.
Yeah.
You know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to write this piece in Hebrew and Arabic and Farsi and Aramaic and English. And they said, okay. And but, you know, that's what I do. You know?
I see her going back to the board and saying, what's he going to write? She said, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, well, but you know, the thing is, what was so funny about this is that, I mean, and this is Anusha Oskuyan. She was the sort of the spearhead behind it. And she loved the idea because the most enlightened Iranians are really peacemakers and poets. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like very different from Arabs who are warriors by nature. The Iranians don't like bloodshed. You know, this is not their thing. And so it was a very appealing to everyone. But what was fascinating about it was that when the week of the premiere came, they all went. The Iranian Jews from L.A. came, and the Iranian Christians who were in Orange County, and the Muslims who were both in Orange County and L.A., they were all there, and they all sat together. And, you know, what was interesting is a few of them had their qualms, you know, about the fact that the piece ended with the Kaddish, with a portion of the Kaddish. Some of them, you know, had their qualms about the fact that why did he include Arabic? It was like the same little... Do you know what I'm saying? But you know what?
It was good.
It was good because for that 52 minutes, they somehow, on a subliminal pre-verbal and post-verbal level, understood that, hey, you know, whether we like it or not, we're all in this together.
Composer Richard Danielpour, the conclusion of our chat will air on next week's program. I hope you can tune in as you digest your Thanksgiving dinner. You can find out more about my guest at his website, richard-danielpour, danielpour.com. The recent recordings of his works are on the Naxos label at naxos.com, and I'll leave you with two movements from his 7 movement, Toward a Season of Peace, an oratorio which explores violence and war in the name of religion, using texts from the Old Testament, ancient Hebrew writings, and Persian and Arab poets. We'll hear the opening, Annunciation, and then the third movement, Celebration. The voice is that of soprano Gila Plitman. The Pacific Chorale and Symphony are led by Carl St. Clair. Music by my guest today, Richard Danielpour. Remember, the conclusion of our chat airs next week. But as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today. And I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.
Mm-hmm.